So, the book of Revelation is a mysterious book. So the basic thing about the book of Revelation, and I wanted to read two pieces from it. So in, again, thinking about the ideal and the real, the book of Revelation is struggling with living under the reality of empire. And by empire, what John means is the Roman Empire. So John the Seer, who is the author of the book, at least that's how he calls himself, living on the island of Patmos, right off of Turkey, the coast of Turkey, Asia Minor. And he's having a vision, or he is writing a prophetic critique of the Roman Empire for the Christian church in symbolic language so that his head won't be cut off. So there are different ways of looking at it. Again, my reading is going to be, my claim is that to understand any of the books of the Bible, you can read them without any background, but I think a historical, cultural context helps you understand what's going on. So that's how I tend to read. And the most important thing with the book of Revelation is genre. People don't understand the genre. We don't have apocalyptic genre today. We have fantasy, we have romantic comedy, we have, you know, horror, we have adventure, we have stupid third grade humor movies, you know, I mean, and if you say any of those genres, right, romantic comedy, you know exactly what you're going to get in that film if you go see it. You know the formula. Sometimes it's nice to be surprised, like when Harry Met Sally first came out, it was surprising, the end. I'm beating myself. But the point is that when you hear a particular genre, you know what it's doing, and you know how it's doing it, and you know what the end is going to be, and you know what the process is going to be. So when first century people heard a book in the apocalyptic genre, or heard a little piece, Paul has little pieces of apocalyptic genre, Gospel of Mark, the 13th chapter is a little, it's called a mini apocalypse, in the apocalyptic genre where Jesus sort of has a vision and talks about the ends of things, people knew what to expect. And what you expect is otherworldly creatures, dreamlike symbols, numbers that represent not numbers and segments of things, but rather organizing structures. So seven was understood to be a whole number, a round number, a number of piece, like creation, right? Six is just short of that, which means it's the opposite. It falls short. So 666 is way, way short of perfection. So it's sort of the opposite of perfection. 10, the number 12 is really important, especially in Judaism, you know, and for Greeks and Romans, the 12 months of the year, but also the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. 12 plus 12, 24 is a nice big good number. Why? 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 apostles, put them together, you get 24. Right, so these numbers do not represent years or segments of time, even though that's what he says. They represent numbers. What happens if you multiply 12 by 12? 44, right, I think. So that number is going to appear, except you may have way expanded, I'm not really 4,000. So I start, you've grown. So I started off talking about the way to understand the book of Revelation. I think the way to understand any of the books of the Bible is through, by understanding the cultural and historical context. And the most important contextualizing piece for understanding the book of Revelation is genre. And the genre of Revelation is called apocalyptic, and it's a genre we don't have today. So we have to do a lot of catching up to figure out what that genre means. So I was talking a little bit about what people would expect in the first century when they picked up an apocalyptic thing or they heard an apocalyptic thing. They would know immediately because it has monsters, has symbolic numbers, it has strange, fantastic beings, and it has segmented space. So in other words, there's the earth, there's under the earth, and there's over the earth. In some of the other apocalyptic literature, there's an apocalypse of Abraham, and Abraham goes up into the seventh heaven, and then the 21st heaven, and then the, you know, on and on and on, but all the heavens he ascends through are special numbers. Okay, so space is organized in levels, and that's called the spatial axis. Time is also organized in segments. Right? So the segments don't correspond. They don't have a direct correspondence to the numbers that are used. But time is segmented. So in Revelation, for example, it'll say, so after a time and two times and then three times and then this will happen. After 144 years and then 12 kings and then this and then. So it's giving you weird things, but weird pieces of time, but they are segmented. And organized along the a temporal axis. So what's the function of that? Well, kind of like Genesis 1, the function of very clear organization of time, even if the numbers don't make sense to human numbers, and clear organization of space is it has a calming effect on people. So the genre is doing two things. For the people for whom it's written, it's both something that will calm them. You don't understand, there's chaotic things happening, the numbers are all upside down and backwards, but God knows what they are. And they're in a clear segment, and the cosmos may seem upside down and topsy-turvy, and all weird things are penetrating different spaces and they're going outside of their boundaries, but God has ordered things and there's a reason for this. So there's a calming factor. And there is a challenging factor. So the challenging factor is here's some crazy stuff that should wake you up and make you think about things in a new way. So it has both of those effects. So far, so good? Genre of Revelation? So John the Seer presents himself as Revelation, the book of Revelation is mixed genre. It starts out with letters, and they are letters to seven churches. And the seven churches are on the coast of modern-day Turkey, Asia, and Smyrna, Laodicea, Philadelphia. They're all, Pergamum. If your Bible has a map, you can kind of trace, and they go in order, and they're all set at a certain distance from each other. That's because they were on a trade route. And so this would have functioned as what we call a circular letter, namely that it's written, it goes to the first church, they read it, they absorb it, they learn it, they copy it, they send it on to the next church, and the next church, and the next church. So each of the churches will actually hear the letter that was meant for all of the churches, in addition to their own letter. And in the seven letters, what you hear is both Laodicea, you're under persecution, I know you've been suffering, here's a word of comfort. And then to Philadelphia, wake up, you're neither hot nor cold, you're in the middle and that's no good, you need to decide which side of the fence you're on and take a stand. So they're each reading about each other, hearing about each other's situation, but also receiving something for them. So it's a mixed audience, it's a mixed genre, and we're not accustomed to reading it. So that makes it a little messy, especially to do what I want to do today, which is to take, I think I want to look at 17 and 18. Is that what I said? It's And then tomorrow I'm gonna look at 21, 22.
Yeah.
So, 17 and 18. Well, let me say, there's a lot of ways of trying to understand the book of Revelation. It basically goes in, it's not linear. So it's more like what, one of those movies that starts at the end and goes backwards and then jumps around to different times. And you're like, oh, wait, how do I, and you have to put it together. So the basic story it's telling is a cosmic story of God, and this is my shorthand for God, God versus the enemy, or evil, or whatever you want to call it. So this is the cosmic story that it's tracing. And the specific story is Jesus as representing God confronting the evil on earth and fighting with the evil on earth as a baby. So none of that makes any sense unless you try and enter dreamscape ideas, right? And that's the language of symbols. So it's going to tell that story three times. And one way to read the book of Revelation is to kind of say, okay, here's his presentation of the first story, here's his presentation of the story told again, here's his presentation of the story told again, each in different ways, a little bit different ways. And we're just looking at two chapters, so I'm not going to take you through all of that, but that might be a way to get into it. All right, so it's not chronological, it's cyclical, it's a cyclical book. And each time it's telling about God versus the enemy. It's talking in symbolic language, and it's functioning both to comfort and to challenge. For John, the enemy is empire. And God is God. And the empire is, and John was writing probably around 90 Common Era, so AD, is that 60 years after Jesus, right, in Asia Minor. So he's writing in this time, 90 Common Era, under the, which empire? Roman Empire. So Rome is the empire at the time that John is writing, but he can't say, down with the White House. I mean, we could say that because we live in the country, we do. But in most places, you couldn't say, down with the dictator, you'd get shot. So one of the things the symbols of the apocalyptic genre do is protect him. So instead of talking about the Roman Empire, he talks about the Babylonian Empire. Right, which we've been talking about. So again, so he's drawing on all of this knowledge of how people, Jews felt in Babylon, how people feel under the Roman Empire, and sort of equating them. So when he says Babylon, he means Rome. Another piece that's important for understanding the book is part of the prophetic genre in the Old Testament. Let's see if I can make this make sense quickly. For the prophets, they often talked about the covenantal relationship between Israel and God as one of marriage. Right? So, in the prophetic literature, you have God, and you have the bride, who is Israel, the people of God. And this is the correct covenant, where the bride Israel becomes the wife of God and partners with God, and God protects the bride and defends the bride. But what happens if the bride goes astray and breaks the covenant? That metaphor then for a theological relationships relationship gets explained in sexual metaphors. Okay, so far so good. So, in other words, if Israel is the bride and Israel goes astray and breaks the covenant, she is whoring on the mountaintops with the other, what do you call them? The other gods. Okay, she left her faithful husband and went off with hither and yon with whoever it was. This is important to understand because Revelation is going to use this to talk about Babylon, okay? So the sexual covenant or the marriage covenant is the language used for talking about Israel and God in the prophets. Okay. So for Israel to be a faithful bride, she has to put away all her adulteries, and come and be faithful to God. So this is the other piece that in a marriage, when you go astray from the covenant, it's called adultery. With God, when you go astray from the covenant, it's idolatry. And in the prophetic literature, those are the same thing. So there's going to be rough sexual language that is trying to describe, John is using it to try and describe how he feels people have rejected God's covenant.
He's just talking directly to these churches?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So that's the big setup. So let me start us out in chapter 17. You can kind of look through the chapters, and there's the first cycle is about a dragon in the desert with a baby and a mother. Then there's a cycle of beasts, and then there's the cycle of the whore. And the whore, in this sense, is not Israel, but Rome. So the sexual language is going to get applied to the empire. And the great whore, Rome, is riding astride this beast, which is the empire. So you have the capital city that is running the empire. And those are that's the idea here. So in chapter 17, we'll start off. And all of this is set up to get to social justice. So we're going to come out in a good place, in a relevant place, I should say. So in chapter 17 of Revelation, John says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls come and said to me, 'Come, I will show,' came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on many waters.'" Okay. Where's Rome located? Off multiple waters, right? So there are these. Babylon wasn't particularly; it was in the middle of the desert, but Rome is. So let me show you the great whore who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Right? So he's writing to Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, a place that was historically run by individual kings, right? Going back to Macedonian Philip IV, who was the father of Alexander the Great, and then little vassal kings all over the empire that got swept up in Greece and then got swept up in Rome. And each of the little kings has had to bow down to Rome. And John is going to describe that in sexual language, because he's coming out of the tradition of the prophets. Does that make sense? No. All right. That's going to look really strange to you. But,
yeah.
Bobby will fill you in. So the kings of the earth have committed fornication with Rome. They've covenanted with her. And with the wine of whose fornication the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk. So imagine the empire, and the kings are all placating the Roman guard and the ruler and everything. And those who are participating in what Rome offers, the Pax Romana, the assurance that if you play along, all of your trade will go smoothly, we'll be doing nice roads, you'll have good aqueducts. I mean, the infrastructure of the Romans was incredible. And so they could provide a lot from Egypt to Macedonia to, you know, almost to the Persian border, and then back over to Spain. So the inhabitants of the earth had become drunk with that, which means they're out of their minds, right? They're not able to judge correctly anymore about the morality of Rome. Okay. So the angel in verse 3, so the angel carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names. And it had 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, if I look down in my notes, let's see, Scarlet Beast, the Roman Empire, full of blasphemous names with 7 heads and 10 horns. These heads and horns, you can count them out. You can try and figure out who they are. I encourage people to figure out who they are within the context of John the Seer. So, rather than going all the way forward in time to Hitler and Mussolini and all those. So this book has, you can number them different ways. Maybe one is Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Gaius, Claudius, Nero, Galba. So they have all the different empires and emperors, and there are different ways you can work out which of the horns is which emperor. But there's about, let's see, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H ways of figuring it out. Why would that be? Why would that ambiguity be important?
Doesn't lose his head.
So he doesn't lose his head. Okay, yeah, that's one reason. But the other reason is the book will last longer. If you're not specific about who the leaders are you're critiquing, but you use symbols, other communities can apply it in their time. So it's protection for the author, but it's also It makes something timeless. It gives you more possibility, which is kind of ingenious.
So did these writers really think that their writing was for the ages?
In the same way that Harriet Beecher Stowe thought she was writing Uncle Tom's Cabin for the ages. I mean, I think I don't know, but my sense is that they were so driven to write something for the communities they were writing to.
I guess they expected the second coming very soon.
Yeah, well, that was their focus.
Mm-hmm.
But when they created something with that passion and the tools that they used, it ended up timeless. Is what I mean. I don't know that their intention was to write something for. Usually not. Usually they're very focused on who they're writing for at the time. That it's applicable or reinterpretable through the ages is. I think that's where the sacredness of the scripture lies, rather than guiding the pen with the hand. So he's having this vision, a woman on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names. And it had 7 heads and 10 horns. There's really no doubt that this is not something you want to tangle with, right? This is something that's supposed to be over there. Keep it at a distance. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls. How does that sound to you?
Royal.
Royal. Rich. Rich.
Martha, what? I said royal.
Oh, you said royal.
Okay,
right. In stereo. Yeah, powerful. She's wearing the best garments at the center of trade, maybe. Holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. Now, if you take that literally, it just sounds really gross. But if you think about it symbolically, so a woman who has no worries, she can ride on a beast and, you know, import the beasts from Africa or Asia or wherever she wants to and have all these luxuries. But what the wine that she's actually drinking out of a golden cup is probably made on the backs of people who barely have enough to eat, right? But that is for her, right? So on her forehead was written a name, a mystery. Even within Revelation, it knows that it's offering things that are hard to understand and that it doesn't expect us to get. And there are things that it will explain in sort of a one-to-one correspondence and other things that it leaves open and ambiguous for multiple possibilities of interpretation. What's written on her forehead? Babylon. Okay. The great mother of whores and of earth's abominations. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. So now the abomination that's in her cup is not just wine, but is blood. So it's a turning upside down of the communion liturgy. Instead of the saints partaking in the blood of Christ, she's drinking the blood of the saints at their suffering, their misery, their abuse. What abuse? We have no idea. There was not a widespread persecution of Christians at this time in the Roman Empire. Much later, 100 years later, but not at this time. There were some local persecutions, like Paul experienced. Paul mostly experienced them from the Jewish side rather than the Roman side, but it would have been local stuff, and it would have been because of some, not because somebody was called a Christian, but because of something else they were disrupting at that time. So this is the vision. And then the angel in verse, let's see, 7, says, here's the mystery. Why are you so amazed? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. What do you hear in that sentence?
The empire will fall.
Okay. The empire will fall.
What is the opposite of you say God is, was, and will come again?
That's right.
This is
good.
Was, is not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When Moses encounters the burning bush, he said, well, what name do I tell the people that God gave me so that they know which God is going to free them from Egypt? And God says, I am. I am, I will be, I will always be. So the opposite of God is the one who is not, who will not be, and is going to destruction, right? Was and is not. So yeah, exactly right, Casey. It's the flip of God's name. And the inhabitants of earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will be amazed when they see the beast, because it was and is not and isn't to come. Yeah, it's playing with these Jewish symbols. And then in the next piece, it's going to tell you stories about the horns and the heads, and these are the things you can apply to different leaders in the Roman Empire and trying to figure out who was what. But the ambiguity is on purpose. Verse 12, and the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they are about to receive authority as kings for 1 hour. You know, together with the beast. They are unyielding in their power and authority. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. Right, so the Lamb is Christ in this symbology. And then verse 15 is interesting. The angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the whore is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So, again, empire. over many nations and kings. The ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the whore. They will make her desolate and naked. They will devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. So how is this empire going to fall? From within, almost. The people that were placating Rome and going along with it then are going to undermine it and take it apart. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out this purpose by agreeing to give their kingdoms to the beast until the word of God will be fulfilled. Is that literal? No. It's a way of understanding that God is in charge of what may seem like chaotic little wars and rebellions around the empire, different kingdoms. The woman that you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Right? So her name is Babylon, but she's the city that rules over all of the empire. What I want to get to is chapter 18, the fall of Babylon. And it sort of pointed to that, right? It talked about the destruction. Let's see. In verse 4, a voice, chapter 18, verse 4, a voice from heaven says, "Come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins." And the "her" here is Rome, is Babylon, the whore, and Simba. And so that you do not share in her plagues. Plagues is from the Moses story, Egypt. So we're drawing from the experience of Babylon, we're drawing from the experience of Exodus. Her sins are reaped as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. What were her sins? This is where we get to the social justice piece. The book of Revelation is critiquing empire. And one of the reasons I think we have difficulty understanding the genre of the book of Revelation in the United States is because we are empire. We are a powerful, authoritative nation that, at least economically, there's control over much of the earth and many kings and kingdoms. Now that's quickly shifting. Sometimes my students say, "No, I don't. I think you're wrong. I think it's not the United States anymore. I think it is the monopolies, right? The business monopolies, the international kind of businesses that are running things. They are empire now, and the U.S. thinks it has power, but really they're in control." So, however you want to think about empire, here are the characteristics of empire. Martha, do you want to read? Let's start at number verse 6.
Okay. Render to her as she herself is rendered, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double draught for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, so give her a like measure of torment and grief. Since in her heart she says, "I rule as a queen, I am no widow, and I will never see grief." Therefore, her plagues will come in a single day, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her.
Okay. So, what did the empire do wrong?
Glorified herself and lived luxuriously.
Lack of humility or arrogance.
Hubris.
And grief. And above other. Yeah.
And sorrow. Or,
yeah. It's sort of the ultimate hubris, right?
Yeah.
Like all pleasure, not seeing any bit of pain.
No empathy.
And
no.
It could imply at the expense of the people.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of get that vibe, right? So, we'll go to the characteristics of empire, which will set us up for the vision of how God resolves empire. What I didn't say at the beginning was the way people read apocalyptic literature today is they say it's the apocalypse is coming, right? It's the end of time. But apocalypse is a Greek word that just means to pull the curtain away, to reveal something. Old-time movie theaters or plays, they would draw the curtain back and you would see this wonderland of Swan Lake or Sleeping Beauty or whatever it was, and you would get pulled into another world. Matrix is the same thing. You know, which pill are you going to eat? You have a choice. And then once you take that pill, you go down the rabbit hole, you see the world the way it really is. So that's the way apocalypse works. It's not talking about the end of the world. It's talking about the end of seeing things the way they are. It's Morpheus coming to the people, Morpheus from the Matrix, coming to the people and say, where your consciousness is now, that's all fake. And I can show you what's real, but you have to come with me. So John says, the way you're living in Rome and you think everything's fine, it's not fine. There's another reality that's underlying all of this. Come with me, let me show you. And he's going to show you in symbolic language. And so he says, you think Rome is all luxury and pleasure and you don't have to worry about suffering and everything? That's what you see? No. Let me show you the reality. This is her funeral bier. She's dying. And it's going to go up in flames. So the sin, if you will, hubris, arrogance, total self-dependence, right? There's no recognition that there's anything outside of her that is important or has power or is even, luxury. Okay, and sort of this hint of, well, maybe there's something deeper. Good. Ryan, do you want to read?
At nine,
the kings of the earth.
And the kings of the earth, who committed fornication and lived in luxury with her, will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, alas, alas, the great city, Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet, all kinds of scented wood, all articles of ivory, all articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, choice flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, slaves, and human lives.
Quite a list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what's the climax?
Human lives.
So, listing all the things that can be traded, right? Cinnamon, India, spices from way over there, this from way over there, and human lives, there's dime a dozen, just marching through. At this time in Rome, a lot of the wealth was coming, well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of the wealth was coming from Egypt, where the agriculture was. But there were different kinds of slavery. So it wasn't like slavery in the South, in the U.S. particularly, but it was in some places better, and in some places a lot worse. So for example, in the mines, you could expect to live maybe 5-7 years if you were a miner, that's how hard they worked you. And so when it's talking about things that you get out of minds, it's also talking about human lives and the effect of the economy on human lives. I just put up kings and merchants because it's sort of naming all the people who make a society run. The authority figures, the leaders, the trade people. I don't know about the cities that you all come from or have experienced, but in LA we have a big problem with slavery. International slavery, sexual trade, actually our students at the college are getting very involved in trying to bring awareness to the kind of slavery that goes on around the world now and to free people. So another indicator of empire is how we enslave one another and what kind of system we have in our marketplace and our commerce. Yeah. But you see how that list works, yeah? You're just reading through stuff, and then you kind of, oh, that's from over there, oh, that's from over there, this is far and wide trade, and then you get to the end human lives. Yeah. Brent, do you want to read the next piece? We're at quarter of, if anybody needs to go. But
the fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your dainties and your splendor are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off, in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas, the great city, clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls. For in 1 hour, all this wealth has been laid waste. More?
Yeah, keep going.
And all shipmasters and seafarers, sailors, and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, alas, alas, the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. For in 1 hour she has been laid waste. Receive over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her.
Mm-hmm. Good, thank you. Yeah. What do you make of all this? Other, we were characterizing what some of the sins of empire were, hubris and arrogance and luxury. Are there others that have come to mind?
Well, doing things at others' expense, profiting through at the expense of others.
Okay.
So, abuse of others.
Misuse.
Mm-hmm. It's really arrogant states where you have that, but
yeah.
Kind of
where do you see that again?
Well, it's just like all the stuff that the city, or, you know, the great city clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels, and like, I don't know. It's just kind of like excessively showing off.
A lot of excess, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of excess is the luxury.
Yeah.
It's not enough to traffic in cinnamon, but all of these things are, you can buy anything. And that's part of the greatness that gets attributed to her. Yeah.
And like the sailors and who profited and the merchants who profit are still like grieving over the loss of all these things that clearly don't matter anymore.
Yeah.
But they're still hung up on it. Like,
Why?
Because that's what made them great. That's what made them powerful.
And then verse 20 is pretty important. Rejoice over her, you old heavenly saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her.
Yeah.
So like, this downfall is reason to rejoice if you're on the right side.
What would it mean for those who are supposed to rejoice? To rejoice at the fall of empire. What will their lives be like?
Freedom, I would presume.
Okay.
Higher status.
Okay. But they may not be able to get paper from China anymore. They may not be able to sell their, you know, things to the cinnamon spice guy anymore. So it doesn't mean things are going to be easy. But it does mean that
the correct order is going to be restored.
Yeah. That a correct order will be restored. Yeah. Yeah. And it also seems to mean that the people who are rejoicing are not kings or merchants or sailors or powerful people. So, in that sense, there is freedom. In the other sense, the society is crumbling and that will be chaotic. Often, I think I mentioned Costco yesterday, but my husband loves Costco, and he likes it because you can get things cheaply, and you can go quickly, and you can get everything you need, and you're done. And he likes to be done, and have it done. I like to go to the farmer's market. And I try to say, but you know, you're not supposed to have apples year-round. You're not supposed to have pears year-round, but I want them. If the right order is restored, it doesn't get easier. It gets harder and more expensive. Like farmer's market, like local. It doesn't get easier. But bless you. You pay the real price for things. Go ahead, Brian. What do you
mean? Just say it's like the kings are connected directly to the slaves, like privilege is connected to disprivilege.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So like, you know, the merchants might be, you can equate them with like, I don't know, so a really poor or artisan or something. Like everyone has to give up some, but like the very bottom people will benefit some. And in a way that is fair. That is like the right order again.
Yeah. And it's you know, it may not be a Marxist socialist model. I don't think that's what John had in mind. That didn't come from a long time later, but there is a leveling here. I'm always struck by the power of Mary's Magnificat in Mary's song in Luke, where she gives praise to God. You know, God just told her, "Hey, unwed mother, guess what? You're pregnant, and it's going to be a great baby." And her reaction is not, "Oh my God, what am I going to tell my family or, you know, my friends speak to me?" But her reaction is, "How amazing. You are leveling, bringing down the powerful and raising up the lowly," including herself, because she's assuming that now unwed mothers will be able to operate in some ways, right? But that's a painful shifting in the categories. And I imagine it takes adjustment for everybody. And some of the people in those seven churches are going to be grieving as well, because there won't be as many people with with cash, you know, the sailors won't have the same cash when they get off the boat and come buy stuff.
It's unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
For a new settling.
Yeah, a few years ago we visited my sister who was in Norway. And we were in Oslo, and I think it's has the highest cost of living kind of in the Western world or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but you know, you, here in America you have these great farmlands, and yet farmers can't make a living.
Yeah.
And in Norway we were driving around, you'd see these rocky fields, little dinky farm, and yet people could make a living because the cost of food was set at a level that they could stay on their farm and live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so it just, you know, you bring that idea to the States and it's like, that's sacrilege, right?
Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay a dollar for my tomato,
right? Yeah. But you know, look at, you know, if you look at how do you take care of everybody all the way down the chain, then the cost goes up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about that in public schools where, you know, they have breakfast programs because you can't think, your brain doesn't work
right.
If you don't have food, and some of these kids aren't getting the rounded nourishment that they need, and yet we're still not willing to pay for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it, a lot of symbolism that we've gone through here, you know, different idolatry and what you worship, and
mm-hmm.
I think we as American Christians need to be careful, because I think we, as a culture, we worship capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And, and that's our...
And it sneaks up on you.
Yeah,
you don't, when you least expect it.
I think, like, I look at that list of like, hubris, arrogance, luxury, abuse of others, and excess, like, that's the United States, pretty much, down pat, and, like, that I didn't realize how much we abused others, and, like, I didn't realize my full identity until I went to India and saw how some of our things are made, and, like, I'm connected to that. Just go to a retail store and walk away like I used to, feeling fine, but like now I understand that like that is inherent in the way that we live, but it doesn't mean it's right.
Mm-hmm.
But then like Julia said, sort of an alternate interpretation rather than the US is mega corporations.
And yet, funnily enough, with capitalism, it seems to be that the way you make the corporations change is by holding them to account and withholding your dollar, right? So cutting back on your own excess, when there is a movement created around that, can push some change. With the fair trade movement, there are problems with that. I don't know what the other hope is.
Well, I feel like those corporations though use the political and military power of the United States to stay afloat. Like I feel like they're still seated in the U.S. even though if they don't care about the U.S. in a way,
mm-hmm.
like they're not intimately tied, but they're still dependent upon the U.S. in certain ways.
Well, and a lot of them,
we have responsibility because of that.
Yeah, and the economics of our military that gets caught up in defending oil-rich places versus Peace Corps-needed places, or AmeriCorps-needed places. Yeah.
This is a really, really helpful overview and explanation of this book. For me, it was just really helpful. Thank you.
Oh, good. I was afraid... We have such a small time to give you a window into how to approach the book, but think about it overnight. We'll have another glance at it tomorrow. This is the real, and we'll move to what God's vision looks like. tomorrow. What's that?
What book's tomorrow? The Bible?
Revelation.
Oh,
we'll look at 20 and 21, 22, the last chapters. Yeah. Let me say a word of prayer and launch us to dinner. Gracious God, we thank you for your word in our lives and the comfort and the challenge and the critique and the revealing that goes on when we get together and explore what each other hears and how we might apply that to our lives or how we might understand what's going on. We give you thanks for this village and for this time and for this place to spend in your word. In Jesus' name.